quantum mechanics review course. My name is Matt Liefer. I'm assistant professor of physics at Chapman University. And I've just here put up the wiki page for this course, just to show you. I have put my email address up there, and I'm happy to take questions outside of class. You can either find me in my office or email me. Yeah, and also, all of the slides for these lectures will be posted in a Dropbox, and there is a link to it here. Is there a pointer? Yes. Good. All right. Also, here is the rough outline for the course that we're going to go through, but I think I'll put up the slides because that'll be clearer. Okay. So let's. Well, that is a crashing PowerPoint.
Are we going to have mostly slides or on Blackboard?
It's mostly going to be slides, but I will post the slides before the lectures. So if you want to follow along on the slides, you can. Or if you want to annotate them, then you can do that. Oh, that's the PDF. Let's see. Now I've also got to get this to display the same. Okay. There we go. Yeah. So these slides are posted on the Dropbox, so you can download them and follow along during the lecture if you want. Also, I should say I encourage people to ask questions anytime during the lecture. I'd rather cover less material and have everybody follow along than get through loads and loads. Okay, so here's the basic outline of the course. Today's lecture, we're going to be just covering the first part. I know it's very soon after the New Year's Eve parties, so you're still recovering. There's going to be a lot of words in this lecture and very few equations, but there's a good reason for that. In quantum foundations, it's an area where people don't even agree with each other on what the question is that we're trying to answer. So it's going to be very important that we establish some sort of common terminology, a common goal for what we're trying to do in this subject before we even get started. That's unlike some other subjects, right? So if you're studying the Standard Model, you want to know how to calculate scattering cross-sections in the Standard Model. Although that's a very difficult thing, it's kind of conceptually straightforward. You know what you're doing. Here, people totally disagree with what even the aim of the subject is. So that's really what we're going to be covering today. Then next time, we'll be covering sort of the basic experiments, the basic things, basic ideas that come up again and again in quantum foundations as a sort of toolbox of ideas, if you like. So then we're going to get on to the main part of the course. We're going to cover the generalized formalism of POVMs, density operators, CPT maps. I know you've seen some of that before in your quantum theory course. The approach I'm going to take to it here is, I think, fairly different from what you've seen before and is designed to give you a bit more of a conceptual understanding of what's going on. Then we're going to talk about ontological models, or what are called realist models of quantum theory. And we're going to talk about all of the difficulties and constraints that come up when you try to pretend that if quantum theory is true, there is something real objectively existing out there. So that's things like Bell's theorem. But I'm also trying to include in that section some very recent results about things like the reality of the wave function. Yes.
Bohmian mechanics, GDS theory.
They are examples of ontological models, but I will cover those in more detail when we get to the last section, interpretations. Okay. Then we're going to have a couple of guest lectures on the classical limit of quantum mechanics. One of the reasons why I'm doing this is because I would like to show or hope to convince you that what you think about the foundations of quantum mechanics can actually affect the way you would go about doing calculations. So I've asked two people to come and talk to you about the classical limit who have very different perspectives on what quantum mechanics means, and you'll be able to see how that affects how they think about this. And then, as I was saying, we will cover the interpretations of quantum mechanics. This is kind of what a lot of people think about when they think of foundations of quantum mechanics. It's actually a much bigger subject, but this is things like the many worlds theory, de Broglie-Bohm theory, spontaneous collapse theories, and I will, in that section, properly tell you what the Copenhagen interpretation means, I hope. Then if we have time at the end, I'm going to do probably one lecture on how can you consistently go about generalizing quantum theory. But we'll see whether we get to that. So today, it's going to be a very wordy lecture, as I said, and I want to basically get to the point where hopefully we're all agreed as to what the goal of this subject is. So quantum foundations is a bit of a weird subject because you won't find it in every single physics program, right? It's still something that most physicists are a little bit dismissive of. So I want to talk a little bit about why we should study it first, and then I'm going to give you a very biased history of quantum mechanics and some very biased comments about the philosophy of science before we, towards the end, will make the question that we're trying to answer precise. And then maybe, probably, we will have time to get into the mathematics of quantum mechanics a little bit. Okay, so as I said, you don't find the foundations of quantum mechanics in most physics programs, undergraduate or graduate. And you know, a lot of physicists are fairly dismissive of the whole subject. So why should you study quantum foundations? Well, a couple of answers that are often given are, well, you know, maybe it will help if we understand quantum theory better to build a theory of quantum gravity. Or maybe the foundations of quantum theory will help us understand how quantum computers are going to work better. Right? Those are reasons that people often give. I say, forget about those. Well, those are very good reasons, but those aren't the main reason. The main reason is this. Probably, before you were even an undergraduate student, you probably read some popular science, some popular physics books about things like relativity and quantum physics. Is there anybody here who didn't do that? Put up your hand if you did read lots of popular physics, right? At least some of you. And so those were very confusing. At least I found those very confusing. So I was like, right, I have to go to university to study physics now and find out about all of these things. So I bet that you probably feel like you understand relativity, at least special relativity, pretty well at this point. All the questions that you had when you were reading those popular science books about relativity, you probably feel like you have a pretty good answer to, right? You know, there's this structure called space-time. We can derive it in the way that Einstein did. And you can get everything by looking at the length of the paths through space-time that things travel, right? And that's a pretty simple picture. Question, do you feel the same way about quantum theory? Is there anybody who does feel the same way about quantum theory? Zero? Oh, that's pretty good if that's true. So, you know, those questions that you probably thought of when reading popular science books, they probably haven't been answered yet. You know, what on earth's going on with Schrodinger's cat, for instance? At least I never felt like those questions were answered in my undergraduate physics degree. What happens instead is that you learn the mathematics of the theory and you learn how to use it, and then you learn to not think about these things, right? Because you don't need it to do calculations. But, you know, trying to understand the physical world, trying to understand all these crazy things that we read about before we started studying physics, that's why we do physics, right? So we don't need any excuses to try and understand that. That should be a fairly straightforward goal. So as far as I'm concerned, that's the reason to study quantum foundations. You thought when you came into physics that you were going to understand, try and understand the physical world. So let's try and actually do that. Now, in this context, it's sort of mandatory to quote Feynman. And you've probably seen this quote multiple times. I think I can safely say that nobody understands quantum mechanics. I think there's virtually no treatment of quantum mechanics anywhere which doesn't quote that at some point. When people quote Feynman saying that, it's usually a scare quote, what I call a scare quote. It's kind of like people say it in order to say, like, you know what, I don't really understand quantum mechanics. You're probably not really going to understand quantum mechanics after we've finished. But don't worry, very smart people also don't understand it. So that's just the way things should be, right? I think instead we should view it as a challenge. Okay, nobody understands it. Let's try to. That's a big, interesting question then. So anyway, this Feynman quote comes from about 1964, a series of lectures that Feynman gave in 1964. By 1982, Feynman was a little bit more circumspect. There's this long quote here which comes from the paper that he wrote where he introduced quantum computers. And at the end here, here's what he says about quantum mechanics is, I cannot define the real problem, therefore I expect there's no real problem, but I'm not sure there's no real problem. So Feynman had sort of changed his mind a little bit towards the end of his life, and in fact did do some work on the foundations of quantum mechanics in the 1980s. So despite the fact that most physicists still quote 1960s Feynman, 1980s Feynman doesn't quite agree. So our main task then, given that it's apparently confusing what the problem is to try and define what the real problem is. Okay, so that's where I hope to get to by the end of the lecture. So here are some answers that are often given, which are definitely wrong. So some people say, well, quantum theory describes a world that's extremely far away from our everyday experience. Right, so you can't see electrons and photons and things. Well, you can't see individual quantum particles with your naked eye. It doesn't correspond to the classical everyday world. Okay, so because it's so far from our everyday experience, why should it be understandable to our intuition, right? Why should it be comprehensible? We just have to get used to the abstraction. That's the end of the story. Forget about it. So that's an answer that you often hear. But of course, many other theories are extremely abstract. Special relativity is quite abstract. General relativity is extremely abstract. And even classical Newtonian mechanics doesn't really make sense to our common sense physics intuition. If you think about it, when you first learned Newton's first law, that things keep moving with a constant velocity, if there's no force acting on them, that we don't experience that in our everyday life. Friction is everywhere, right? So, you know, all of physics is counterintuitive to some extent, but that doesn't mean that we should give up on the task of trying to understand. Now, another answer is that, well, what we commonly do in physics, quantum physics, is we separate it into its practical part, the stuff that you need to do to compute scattering amplitudes and things like that, and the interpretation, this sort of woolly philosophical interpretation part. And the idea is that, well, you know, interpretation, that's all very well and it's all very interesting, but it's completely irrelevant for any practical physics. Let's just leave it to the philosophers. I think this is completely wrong, right? I don't believe that there's any physical theory in which we ought to separate the interpretation as a separate, impractical part. Imagine doing that for any other area of physics. You know, imagine somebody came along and said, well, you know what, I've got the Lorentz transformations, I know how to compute everything in special relativity. Why are you giving me all of this stuff about postulates, about the invariance of the speed of light and reference frames and things? Why are you trying to derive this for me? I know the mathematics, right? So fine, right? We don't say that for any other area of physics, and in fact, I think it's actually not true. It's a selection effect, right? Because people don't want to think about the interpretation of quantum theory, then they don't think about applications of quantum theory in which the foundations of the theory are relevant, right? So in some sense, the rise of quantum information science has shown that's wrong, right? Because we needed to think about the weird parts of quantum mechanics in order to develop that subject. And in fact, you know, the fact that we only really got into gear in the late 1980s shows that we were kind of missing something by not taking the foundations seriously. It's foundations of quantum mechanics has led to many novel experiments, for example, Bell experiments, many more than some other foundational areas of physics. And another important thing is that we don't know for sure. You know, it should always be on the table somewhere that our current theory of physics may break down somewhere. If you don't understand the foundations of quantum theory, then it's very difficult to understand how quantum theory could possibly break down and what could replace it. My colleague Rob Speckens likes to make an analogy here. He likes to say that pretty much all physicists use quantum mechanics, so it's kind of like driving a car. Doing the foundations of quantum mechanics is like being a mechanic who knows how to fix the engine of the car. Okay, so maybe not everybody needs to do it, but surely it's good that there are mechanics out there. However, in the current situation, it's not exactly like that. It's like most of the physicists who are driving the car not only just drive the car, they also say, I don't believe that car mechanics exist. I don't believe that car mechanics are actually needed. What's this car mechanics stuff that you're talking about? Cars just work. So anyway. All right. So okay. So in this next section, I want to give a very biased history of quantum theory, which emphasizes the things which I think are important for the foundational mess that we're in. So here is a timeline of things which I think are most important for the foundations of quantum mechanics. Of course, there's loads of history of quantum theory, and I haven't included anywhere near everything here. So I personally like to divide the development of quantum theory into three periods: first quantum revolution, second quantum revolution, and third quantum revolution. This is very non-standard. Most people talk at most about two quantum revolutions. but starting in the 1900s, we had what was called the old quantum theory. That's the first quantum revolution. And this is basically a series of rules of thumb that don't make any sense as a coherent theory. So starting with the explanation of black body radiation by Max Planck, we introduced the quantization hypothesis, and then later other things were introduced, like such as de Broglie wavelengths and things like that. However, at this stage, there isn't a coherent theory. The quantum theory that you have at this stage actually contradicts the rest of your theories of physics. So you have to use good taste and judgment to decide when to use the quantum postulates and when not to use the quantum postulates. So you always divide your system in this period into a quantum part that you're going to apply one of these kinds of formulas to and the rest of the system that you're going to treat classically. So for example, in the explanation of the photoelectric effect, Einstein treats the radiation field as if it's quantized, but the electrons there are just ordinary classical particles. And whichever explanation you look at, there's always some semi-classical aspect to it like that. So obviously, this situation was unsatisfactory, and then we had the second quantum revolution, but beginning in 1925, we had two different formulations of quantum theory, which were then unified in the current formulation that we use. And that's quantum mechanics pretty much as it stands. During this whole period, Copenhagen interpretation of quantum mechanics was pretty much totally dominant. But things begin to break down a bit in the 1950s. Okay, so I identify about the mid-1950s as the beginning of the third quantum revolution. As far as revolutions go, it's an extremely slow burn revolution because it hasn't taken over all of physics yet, but that's where the origins start. And what I think was going on in that revolution is that some people came along and said, you know what, we have to take quantum theory deadly seriously as a fundamental physical theory. There's no classical world, just quantum mechanics, that's it. Okay, so then we have to understand, you know, what's going on with this split between the quantum and classical world that happens in Copenhagen. So in the 1950s, you have David Bohm, Everett and the many worlds interpretation, and that led to, for example, the work of John Bell, which he was very interested in the Bohmian theory, for instance. So the idea that there's a wave function of the entire universe gets promoted at this time, particularly by people like Wheeler and DeWitt, and arguably it led to the ideas which later turned into quantum computation. So some people like to say that quantum computation is a revolution in physics. I think it's an application of this particular revolution. Okay, so some of this I've said already. So the old quantum theory wasn't a full physical theory. It was always necessary to judiciously choose which part of the system to apply quantum rules to, leaving the rest classical. Now, if you know about the Copenhagen interpretation, this survived, right? We had the full quantum mechanics, but you still divided the world into a quantum part and a classical part, or a system and a measuring device, if you like. Initially, this didn't actually bother physicists much. Why would it? They've been doing it all the time, right? It was part of the quantum physics that they were already doing. So it was like natural, okay, it would be better not to have it, but we've been doing this anyway. And Copenhagen interpretation made that into a virtue rather than a vice. It's like, okay, that's the way physics is. Okay, so in the second quantum revolution, Heisenberg's matrix mechanics came along first. Now, if you go back to the original papers, his initial idea is that systems were always in what we would now call a stationary state. So the idea is that, for example, an atom is in a definite energy state. This is the initial idea. And from time to time, there's a stochastic, probabilistic, indeterministic jump from one level to another. So that's what he thought. And the other variables, the ones that ended up becoming matrices, they were sort of there just to sort of aid in the calculations. So that was his initial idea, but of course, that won't get you all of quantum mechanics. You need non-stationary states. We can have superpositions of energy eigenstates. Those ended up being added later, less than a year later, in his paper with Born and Jordan. They were quite alien to his initial thinking. His initial idea was, you know, we have atoms in definite energy levels, they jump around stochastically. So then Schrödinger comes along with his wave equation. So Schrödinger initially thought that his wave function was a physical field, like a wave, like a wave on water, like an electromagnetic wave, something like that. He didn't have a probability rule, just the wave equation. And particles, the particle aspect of quantum mechanics was somehow supposed to emerge from that. I don't know, maybe there was going to be some kind of soliton type of solution which would correspond to a particle. That was his idea. He was forced to give this up when later on it was found that if you put in a realistic Hamiltonian, so one with interaction terms, then wave functions necessarily have to spread in time. This isn't true for all Hamiltonians. For example, a harmonic oscillator Hamiltonian, you can have wave functions that don't spread. But for realistic ones, that always happens.
What do you mean by spread?
What I mean is, if you consider, say, a wave function of a single particle, and you imagine that it's localized in space initially, then it disperses, spreads out. So that made the physical field interpretation difficult in light of the fact that we detect things as particles. There weren't any particle-like solutions. So when Max Born introduced the probability interpretation, so we think of them now as probability waves, Schrödinger was eventually forced to accept it. Okay, so the point with all this history is that, so we then end up with two mathematical theories, the Heisenberg theory based on matrix mechanics with the addition of non-stationary states, and the Schrödinger theory with wave functions with the addition of the probability postulate. Okay, now when you have those two theories, then you can show, and was initially shown by these people. In fact, Schrödinger's original paper on this is kind of interesting because he showed that they were equivalent before the two theories were even complete. All he actually showed was that the spectrum of the Hamiltonians that you get will be the same in both pictures. But then later on, Dirac and von Neumann showed the equivalence, and that resulted in our modern formalism. What I want to say is that, obviously, those are mathematically unified, but what I want to say here is that these were never conceptually unified, right? So initially, there were two perfectly coherent ideas of what quantum theory is about, right? Either it's about stationary states that jump, there are quantum jumps in time, or it's about waves in physical space. The unification is true to neither of those original pictures, right? We had to borrow something from the other picture in order to make the full theory. So Heisenberg had to borrow the idea of non-stationary states. Schrödinger had to borrow the idea of probabilities, which were built into Heisenberg mechanics at the outset. And this is why I think it's become unclear what the theory was fundamentally about, right? Because you had two coherent pictures, but neither of them actually worked. So this leads to something that I like to call the two churches of quantum theory. Now, in borrowing this terminology, I have to give credit. The term the church of the larger Hilbert space is very common in quantum information theory. It's due to John Smolin, and he uses it for the idea that you can always consider any quantum process as basically being about a pure quantum state that evolves in time according to the Schrödinger equation. Okay, so we don't think that the Schrödinger and Heisenberg pictures are inequivalent in any way, but they lead to two very different conceptual ideas of what the theory is fundamentally about. Okay, the church of the larger Hilbert space, this sort of owes a debt to the Schrödinger kind of approach. This says, well, quantum theory is fundamentally just another dynamical theory, like a classical field theory or something like that. You know, we have an object, a field-like object called the wave function. We have an equation of motion. It's a bit like classical field theory, right? So everything about the theory should be derived from the point of view of having a wave function which evolves in time unitarily according to the Schrödinger equation. Okay, so that's one intuition that people have about quantum theory. Then there's something that I call the church of the smaller Hilbert space, you'll see why, which is derived more from the Heisenberg point of view. It says, well, you know what, that's not what's going on. What's going on is that something weird happened to the physical quantities. Right? So the algebra of physical observables, it became non-commutative. We have commutation relations now and those kinds of things. How should we think about quantum theory? Well, quantum theory is just the only way that you can make a probability theory for such variables. Right? It's the only way you can do it in a consistent way. You're going to get all the rest of the equations of quantum theory once you take this point of view. Yeah?
I thought that these two ideas were kind of put together in like objects like the interaction Hamiltonian, for example?
You mean the interaction picture? Are you talking?
Yeah.
So I mean, mathematically, these two points of view are equivalent. At least, when you're not talking about the interpretation of the theory, this is mathematically it's completely equivalent. So long as we're agreed on what a measurement is and that those kinds of things, as we normally are, then mathematically you can do your calculations either way, you can derive the theory either way. But what I'm trying to say here is that when you're trying to think about what is it that people actually think quantum theory is fundamentally about, or how would you go about generalizing quantum theory, for instance, then these two points of view will give you very different intuitions as to how to go about doing that. So, you know, I wanted to talk about this before we talk anything about interpretations of quantum theory, because, like, normally people just go in and say, okay, here's an interpretation of quantum theory, here's another one. But I tend to find that there's a very big divide in the community between people who are fundamentally thinking this way and people who are fundamentally thinking this way. If you're fundamentally thinking this way, then something like the Everett interpretation, many worlds, in which you just have a wave function which, of the universe, which is evolving unitarily in time, is going to seem very natural. As if you think this way, you might look at something like, I don't know, quantum logic or decoherent histories type of approach and say, well, those are based on algebras of observables, so that's right. So before we even talk about interpretations, it's good to be aware that there's really a fundamental sort of split in people's thinking. Yeah.
How is that Hilbert space in which sense larger?
That we will talk about in a couple of lectures time, right? Because if when you're working in the generalized formalism of density operators and things like that, right, that they live on a certain Hilbert space. But if you want to think that it's really always a pure state, then you need a larger Hilbert space on which it's everything's purified. That's the sense in which it's larger and smaller. Okay. So then I think I said all this already. So starting in the 1950s, people became dissatisfied and started to think about what would happen if you tried to describe the whole universe as a quantum system. So this is still an ongoing revolution. Okay, any questions about that? As I said, that was a very biased history, which only included certain things that are relevant to what I want to talk about. This next piece is going to be even more biased because, you know, I'm not a philosopher. I've read a fair amount of philosophy of science. If you're serious about studying the foundations of quantum theory, you are going to need a little bit of philosophy of science. Otherwise, you're going to get very confused as to what we're actually trying to do. So there's a few things that you really need to know. If you are interested in the philosophy of science more generally and you want a good background on it, this is the textbook that I recommend for a beginner. So philosophy of science is a big subject, and it includes things like how can we tell if something's a scientific theory or not. Fortunately, we're in a bit of a better position than general philosophy of science. We have a scientific theory. It's called quantum mechanics. We all agree that it's a scientific theory, I hope. So then the only things that are really going to be relevant from the philosophy of science are ideas about what should scientific theories look like, right? If you want to answer the question, do we have a complete understanding of quantum theory, then you need to know what does it mean to have a complete understanding of a physical theory in general. So although philosophy might be a bit painful for physicists, it's useful to spend a few minutes thinking about this just so that we can get our terminology straight later on. Okay, so I want to contrast two big ideas about scientific theories. There's going to be scientific realism and anti-realism. So, by the way, scientific realism is a very big and complicated subject. If you go on the Stanford Encyclopedia of Philosophy, you'll see a big long article with many different definitions of different subtypes of realism, right? So whatever I say here, somebody's going to disagree with it. As far as I'm concerned, the purpose of this course, this is what I mean by scientific realism. Okay, first point. There exists an objectively real physical world which is independent of us. Okay, there's stuff out there, right? If all physicists and all intelligent life were somehow wiped out from the universe, there'd still be stuff. There'd still be planets, there'd still be electrons and that kind of thing, right? So these are real things out there. I presume that this lectern here, those chairs, those are some of those things. Okay, so then the job of a physical theory, according to the realist, is to attempt to describe this objective physical world. Yeah.
So you say that independent of observers, there is a laptop there. What do you mean by there is? Does that mean that it needs to have a definite position and momentum, or?
Definitely not. All I mean is something very vague. It doesn't actually even really matter if this laptop is here, right? What matters is that we think that there's some stuff out there, whatever it is, and we're attempting to describe it. So, you know, it's contrasting to the view of idealism where you think absolutely everything's in the mind. That's basically it. It doesn't matter if it has the degrees of freedom of classical physics or not. They don't have to be the degrees of freedom of classical physics.
Okay, but it doesn't matter whether you're talking about a laptop or stuff, but you still use the words there is.
There is, yes.
It's very, very vague.
Okay, so we can go to another Stanford Encyclopedia of Philosophy article and look up existence, which is another.
I think here are the minds of the word there.
What I have in mind, what I have in mind when I say that is roughly, if you're philosophically sophisticated at all, I roughly have something like a correspondence theory of truth going on there. So, you know, when I write down some property in mathematics and I say these are the physical properties of the system, I mean that there's something out there in the world that corresponds to that. That's roughly what I mean by that. But not exactly. I'll get a bit more subtle later. But we can talk about it after class if you... all of these things are very... You know, the way I like to see it is that, you know, any subject, if you delve deeply enough into the foundations, you'll see that it's built on sand, right? Because, you know, just like a, you know, 5-year-old child, you can always ask another why question. Why, you know? So at some terms, we're going to have to accept as relatively undefined in some way. Okay, so that's the job, right? Now, the real core claim of scientific realism is that our successful physical theories are, in some sense, approximately correct descriptions of this objective physical world. And what I mean by that is to say that if you have a theory which has theoretical entities in it, say classical electromagnetism with electrons in it, then it's more accurate, somehow a better picture of reality to go around thinking that electrons are things that exist, then they're not doing so. Okay, so you can always, reason why I'm hedging so much here is, of course, we never end up at the final physical theory, right? So the picture that we can have of reality in our physical theories may be actually quite inaccurate. So what I'm talking about here is theories being somehow more accurate descriptions. You never end up with an exact description of what's out there. But that's the basic idea of scientific realism. And to reiterate some things, because this often comes up in quantum foundations, realism does not necessarily mean any of these things. Definite positions and momentums will be one of them. So the idea that all quantum observables have definite values at all time, or that the quantum state is a description of reality, or that nature must be deterministic, or that her theories are literally true descriptions of reality. None of those things are what scientific realism means. Although if you go and read papers on the foundations of quantum mechanics, you will find various authors using them that way. So it can be confusing. Okay, so real realism, just the idea that there's something out there and we're trying to describe it, is much harder to deny than these more specific kinds of realism, I would say.
A
quantum state is a description of reality. What else?
Sorry?
I mean, why is this not, why is this different from the other?
Because it may be that some other aspect of the mathematical formalism of quantum theory describes reality. It might be that observables having definite values describes reality, for instance, and that this is just something like a probability distribution. So we don't necessarily want to commit to any of those particular more specific views. Okay, so anti-realism exists as well. Here are some words that are associated with anti-realistic points of view: idealism, logical positivism, empiricism, instrumentalism, operationalism. You may have seen some of these words. I usually find that when philosophers use these words, philosophers of physics, they usually mean them as insults. They usually say, ah, you're a logical positivist. That's a bad thing. But these are sort of, this is sort of a constellation of ideas which are subtly different from one another. And I don't want to say that they're necessarily wrong. Maybe at the end of the day, quantum mechanics will push us in this direction, but we ought to at least see whether that's really true. So the basic thought behind these kinds of points of view is that the only thing that we actually have direct access to are your perceptions. Or, on some views, people say the objective results, recorded measurements of experiments. So maybe you've got some experimental results written down on a piece of paper, but you haven't actually directly seen the electron yourself, right? So those are the only things that we know for sure exist, right? So our theories must simply be systems for organizing or predicting those regularities in those things, okay? So in this view, a theoretical entity, something like an electron, would be a convenient fiction, which you'd use it in your calculations, but you wouldn't actually believe that there's really something out there called an electron. There's just electron-like measurement results. Okay. In particular, I want to pick out this one because I think this is the most relevant for quantum foundations, which is operationalism. According to the operationalist, every statement that you make in a theory should, in principle, be able to be boiled down to a list of instructions for what to do in the lab and what you'll see as a result. So operationalism came from the ideas of Percy Bridgman. And actually, Einstein's special relativity was a huge inspiration for operationalism. People looked at his derivation of relativity and said, oh, right, we got the right theory when we started thinking about distances in terms of things that you measure with meter rulers, and times, in terms of bouncing light off things, right? So actually, in that derivation, he gave a physical prescription for how to measure the things he was talking about. And that has been very influential on quantum mechanics as well. Like Heisenberg was greatly influenced by that. So operationalism has a sort of deep roots within quantum theory. Okay, so how are we doing for time? Badly. Okay. I just wanted to briefly, these realism versus anti-realism are big debates with many, many arguments, and you can read about it in the philosophy of science. I just wanted to sort of highlight one argument on each side. One argument that people have often said is the most convincing argument in favor of realism is Hilary Putnam's no miracles argument. Well, let me just read out this quote because I won't put it in better words than him. So he says, when they argue for their position, realists typically argue against some version of idealism. In our time, that would be positivism or operationalism. Here we go, all of these isms associated with this anti-realistic point of view. And the typical realist argument against idealism is that it makes the success of science a miracle. So the modern positivist has to leave it without explanation, the realist charges, that electron calculi and space-time calculi and DNA calculi correctly predict observable phenomena if in reality there are no electrons, no curved space-time, and no DNA molecules. If there are such things, then a natural explanation of the success of theories is that they are partially true accounts of how those things behave. And a natural account of the way scientific theories succeed each other is that a better account of the same object, And a natural account of the way that scientific theories succeed each other is that a partially correct or incorrect account of a theoretical object is replaced by a better account of the same object or objects. But if those objects don't really exist at all, then it is a miracle that a theory which speaks of gravitational action at a distance successfully predicts phenomena. It's a miracle that a theory which speaks of curved space-time successfully predicts phenomena. And the fact that the laws of the former are derivable in the limit from the laws of the latter theory has no methodological significance. Right? So the basic idea here is that if you're an anti-realist, all that exists are, you know, perceptions, marks on paper, things like that. And it's absolutely, I mean, why should those things have any kind of regularity in them at all? Why should the fact that they previously had regularity induce us to think that they will in the future? Yeah.
So you're saying that measuring an electron to be in a certain position would have a very small probability. But how can you even talk about the probability of measuring an electron if there's no realism? If there's no realism, there is no electron. What does measurement mean?
Well, it means the probability that I will have a certain perception, for instance.
But there's no I.
Well, anti-realism is usually realistic about the self, right? It just doesn't take this. So behind what you're saying is this kind of reductionist point of view that you have physical reality and things are derived in successive layers from that. If you're an anti-realist, you don't believe that. Right? You can't possibly believe that physics, the ultimate theory of physics, is the bottom from which everything is derived, because you think, you believe more in the self. Yes?
You can ask the same questions about the realistic point of view as well, because you could also ask, why would nature have any irregularities? So exactly the same question, just with a different sort.
Sure, and that's probably what an anti-realist would counter. You know, how can you... Yeah, so... I'm not saying this is a slam dunk argument, and these are bigger arguments. Let's go to the anti-realist side. I like this one. This is Arthur Eddington. He was, Arthur Eddington, you probably know. He is famous for confirming Einstein's general relativity by looking at the deflection of stars. But he also wrote a lot of popular science. This kind of thing was regarded as popular science in the 1930s. You can see that in the meantime, things have become dumbed down quite a lot. Now it would be regarded as philosophy of science. So I kind of like this story he gives. So let us suppose that an ichthyologist is exploring the life of the ocean. He casts a net into the water and brings up a fishy assortment. Ichthyologist is someone who studies sea life, basically. Surveying his catch, he proceeds in the usual manner as of a scientist to systematize what it reveals. He arrives at two generalizations. One, no sea creature is less than 2 inches long. And two, all sea creatures have gills. These are both true of his catch, and he assumes tentatively that they will remain true however often he repeats it. In applying this analogy, the catch stands for the body of knowledge which constitutes physical science, and the net for the sensory and intellectual equipment which we use in obtaining it. The casting of the net corresponds to observation, for knowledge which has not been or could not be obtained by observation is not admitted into physical science. An onlooker may object that the first generalization is wrong. There are plenty of sea creatures under 2 inches long, only your net is not adapted to catch them. The ichthyologist dismisses this objection contemptuously. Anything uncatchable by my net is ipso facto outside the scope of ichthyological knowledge. In short, what my net can't catch isn't fish. Or to translate the analogy, if you are not simply guessing, you are claiming a knowledge of the physical universe discovered in some other way than by the methods of physical science, and admittedly unverifiable by such methods. You are a metaphysician, bah. So I kind of like this story because when you read it, you would think that he was going to make the opposite point. And it's obvious that there are sea creatures under 2 inches long, right? We know that there are now. It's obvious that this guy is in some sense wrong. But the point he's trying to make is that, you know, if you have absolutely no way of measuring something, then what can you really, you know, you can't say anything scientifically about what about whether it is, exists. So it may be tomorrow that a better net comes along. But as far as we're concerned today, there's only the fish that we can catch with this net, right? So somebody comes along and posits something and says, this will have no observable consequences whatsoever, ever. There'll be no method of measuring it. Then we would clearly call that not science. So what he's saying here is that what science depends on, you know, what you can do in the lab, basically.
Yes, so in this sense, science is not about what exists, but what science becomes epistemological. What we can know.
What we can know about, right. We can distinguish between what exists in general and what can exist as a scientific fact. I would do that in a minute. I'm supposed to stop soon, aren't I?
10 minutes. 10 minutes.
Okay, I try not to go over too much because I know you're tired after several lectures. Okay, so realism versus anti-realism. It's certainly undeniable that what we can measure affects what we can theorize about. If I make a theory which says there are green aliens on Mars, by the way, they have absolutely no interaction with any other physical system, right? They're completely invisible, they don't smell, they don't emit any radiation of any sort, they don't emit dark matter or anything, then that's not scientific. It might be true, depending on what your theory of truth is, but it's certainly not a scientific truth, it's not part of physics. So anti-realists insist that this idea is primary, that's what everything's built on, what's measured. But however, it's also undeniable that you have to rely on your theories to define or even interpret what you can measure. This is called, philosophers say that measurements are theory-laden. Experiment is theory-laden, right? So if I take a telescope and I look at the moons of Jupiter, in order to say something about the moons of Jupiter, I need to rely on the fact that, well, I built this telescope, I used my theories of optics to build it, I know various things about the theory. In some sense, the theory tells us what's measurable, right? So the theory should be primary because in order to determine what we can measure, we need to use our theories. So for example, if you're an operationalist, you'd have a hard time explaining how you can redefine the meter, right? Meter is originally defined as the length of a certain stick, and then it gets redefined as the distance that light travels in a certain time period, right? Why are they measuring the same thing? Well, if you believe the theory is true, then you have an explanation for that. The theory tells me these things measure the same thing and that this is more accurate than that. But if you think that everything boils down to the measurements ultimately, then you've completely changed the meaning of the meter when you do that. So realists insist that this is primary, the theory, the theoretical description of reality is primary. In reality, what's going on, according to me, is something more like this. Okay? What we know about reality, our theories, tell us something about what we can measure. What we can measure constrains what we know about reality, and it goes around in a cycle like this. And in these debates, we kind of want to cut this cycle at one side or the other. That's clearly not what's happening. We're sort of pulling ourselves up by our bootstraps. I'm calling this Leiferian pragmatism just because I know several people who are pragmatists and they would probably argue with everything, but I'm not claiming any originality here. So what I would say is that at least part of what distinguishes scientific truth from some other type of knowledge, if you believe that there are things like artistic truth or religious truth, whatever, let's put those to one side. What distinguishes scientific truth from other types of knowledge without codifying it too much is that it has a certain, it's useful in a certain sense. But I want this useful term not to be too specific. I want to interpret it very broadly. It could be because it allows you to make correct predictions. Because it provides you with explanations which then help you to derive other things more quickly, more ably than you would otherwise. Maybe it leads you to new experiments that you wouldn't have thought of otherwise, or different ways of generalizing the theory. Those are all examples of things that are useful, in my view. Okay, so pragmatism is the idea that truth equals utility in some sense, although some pragmatists would deny that. I'm not going to go as far as that, but what I want to say is that an important part of what makes something a scientific truth as opposed to another truth, other kind of truth, is it has this sort of character. Okay, so given that, you don't necessarily have to be a realist to realize that realist explanations are often useful. So if I have a story about things that exist and how they behave, then I have a framework for reasoning about novel physical situations, like what should happen in this new situation. Well, if these are the things that exist and this is the general principles of how they behave, let me now apply it to the new situation, right? That's a very useful idea. If you think about, let me give an example here. Let's talk about thermodynamics and statistical mechanics. Thermodynamics, in its original formulation, is definitely an operational theory. It's about things that you can and can't do in the lab. You can make this kind of heat engine, you can't make that kind of heat engine, right? It's hard to deny that it's useful to have a story underlying that in terms of the motion of particles. It allows us to generalize thermodynamics. It allows us to see that there are non-equilibrium systems, for instance. So regardless of whether you are actually a scientific realist or not, it's still interesting that all of our physical theories prior to quantum theory do admit a realist account, even if you don't believe it. You don't have to believe it, but it's there. So you might still be interested in the question, why can't we find a realist account that we all agree on for quantum theory? Even if you don't think it's a literal description of reality, you don't have to. You can still admit that it's useful when we have such things. So why can't we do it here? So you don't have to be a realist to be interested in realist theories. And similarly, you don't have to be an operationalist to be interested in what I call operational methodology, right? So you don't have to be an operationalist to realize that if you step back from trying to provide a realist account and temporarily try to define things in terms of what we can do, that's often useful. That's what Einstein did in special relativity. Einstein was not an operationalist, but he realized that something funny was going on in space with space and time, and that he needed to be able to redefine them. But they were so fundamental to the formulation of the theories that you really need to take it apart, completely apart, in order to be able to do that. So stepping back and treating things operationally is one way of doing that. Once you're done, you can go back and say, well, this is really the real physical structure of space-time. You don't need to maintain the operationalism. So the operational implications of quantum theory, what it says about the lab, that's the only part everyone really agrees on. So it might be useful to reformulate the theory operationally, come back to the realism question later. I want to think about thermodynamics here again. Original formulations of thermodynamics were in terms of heat engines, and the second law said, you know, can't build a heat engine that just turns heat into work, for instance. Imagine trying to find the realist underpinnings of that prior to the introduction of the concept of entropy. It's clear that it would be very difficult to find within Newtonian mechanics a counterpart of a heat engine. But once you've reformulated the theory operationally in terms of the more general concept of entropy, it's much easier to do it. So the argument is that something similar might be true of quantum theory. We're deeply ingrained in the standard Hilbert space formalism and trying to interpret that, but maybe we should, okay, let's step back from this, let's try to rebuild the theory maybe in a more general way, just in terms of stuff that we all agree on. Okay, so this is the last bit I'm going to do today. And then I have a better idea of how much material will fit in lectures. So given all that, I now want to make the question precise. Okay, so this is the question that ultimately everybody should be trying to answer in quantum foundations, in my view. If quantum theory is approximately a correct theory of physics, which it is, what kinds of things exist and how do they behave? Right, so if you're a realist, then you have to give me some physical stuff here. I do accept the anti-realist answer. You could answer here, only perceptions exist. That's a possible answer. But then you have to answer the rest of the questions too. Second question is, how do they save the phenomena? That's a technical philosophical term, so I'll explain it in a minute. And then number three, because I'm a pragmatist, I'm going to say do so in such a way that leads to progress in physics. So let me break this down a bit more. Just a couple more slides to go. Okay, so the ontology question, what kinds of things exist and how do they behave? So I call this the ontology question because ontology is the philosophical study of what exists. So this is asking for the ontology underlying quantum theory. I want to say we're not asking here what actually exists in the world, because quantum theory isn't a final theory of physics, but rather what would exist, what's the best thing to say exists in a world where quantum theory isn't exact theory of physics. So it's more about the explanatory structure of the theory itself than it is about the real world outside. Real world may be described by string theory, or some, you know, string theory is a quantum theory, but it may be some other crazy theory that we haven't come up with yet. I'm not assuming realism. You can answer only measurement outcomes if you want. This is the important part. You have to save the phenomena. Saving the phenomena means what you see should be explained, right? So what we see in experiments should be explained in terms of your answer to what, right? So if you say particles exist, then I want to say, okay, how is the fact that my measurement device points here explained in terms of particles? How is it that the particles are really there? Okay. So this has two parts. So you've got to explain, you've got to reproduce the quantum predictions. So in a quantum mechanical experiment, you need to get the right predictions. But you also need to just explain the emergence of the classical world, because that should be a prediction of quantum mechanics in the appropriate limit. Right? So if you say particles exist, then why in everyday circumstances do they sit in tables and things like that? Right? So the green aliens running around on Mars that don't interact with anything is an answer to question one, but you can't answer question two. And the third one, this would be more controversial amongst my colleagues. I say you need to do so in a way that leads to progress in physics. The point is that we have already several viable answers to one and two. There are many interpretations of quantum theory that work. Okay, they answer questions one or two. How are we going to know which one's correct? Since I don't believe that there should be a separation between interpretations and the rest of physics, I need a way of telling which one's scientifically correct. Well, obviously, if I make a prediction that conflicts with standard quantum theory and is subsequently confirmed, or if the particular idea allows me to generalize quantum theory, for example, to quantum gravity in a way that other approaches don't, right? And that turns out to be correct, it may make no different prediction from standard quantum theory in everyday quantum experiments, but if it allows you to do that, it would be correct. Maybe it provides better explanations. Right? So if it has this kind of utility that I was talking about, then that's the way that you can potentially, out of the mud, determine which one is the correct idea. So I think I'm going to leave it there for now. Are there any questions about any of that? Let me say one final thing, which will connect to what I say tomorrow. A lot of people will say the goal of quantum foundations is to solve the measurement problem. You will notice that I did not say those words. As far as I'm concerned, this is a more general project than solving the measurement problem. We solve the measurement problem multiple times. Every interpretation of quantum theory does it. And yet we still don't agree on these things. Okay, thanks. That's it for today.